the house, the clinics, someone comes up to you and says, my father, my brother, my grandparents, my coach, somebody has injuries. So when we asked him to speak, this is kind of the seed we gave him and asked him if he would talk about some injuries in older athletes. So this is what he's going to talk about. So here we go, Dr. Michael Kent.
I appreciate that, Mike. Mike and I met each other years and years ago when he was ending his athletic training career, kind of formally, at the Seven Lakes High School. I then went to work with HBU for a couple of years, and then now I work with Needville. Go Blue Jays. And so I am somewhat removed, however, from the sports world, and that a lot of my practice is centered around knee replacements. And so when Mike asked me to talk, I kind of thought, well, I'm not sure that I'm going to have all that glamorous a talk compared to what y'all hear all day. I know that you've heard about all the injuries that you treat on a daily basis, but this is somewhat applicable because I think that not only do people like Mike, you know, as they get older, have problems with their knees, but also we have parents, and we have parents of the kids that we're seeing that have knee problems, and it's not uncommon. Y'all are very well aware that they might ask you a question or two. Certainly, I've gotten questions from parents about their own knees or ankles or shoulders or whatever while on the sideline. It has nothing to do with playing sports, or at least at that point, obviously. And so I'm going to talk today about knee conditions, specifically knee arthritis, as it applies somewhat to what we're talking about with ACL injuries and meniscectomies and things like that. So I do realize, well, real quick, I guess I have to let y'all know nobody pays me because nobody really thinks my opinion is valuable enough to pay me for it. Therefore, I have nothing that would influence what I tell you today. So I realize you've probably seen this picture 4 million times, and this, of course, is very, very glamorous, and I think it's great. And you know, taking care of athletes that are at the peak of their sport is truly, truly an honorable thing to do, and it's really amazing to be able to take care of these people. I have treated NFL athletes or NFL players, however, mine look a little more like that. All right. And so the reason I make that point is that, yes, we look at a guy and like that and probably say, well, goodness, that's not exactly, you know, again, as cool as that. But this person, that person, needs love too. And so the good news is that as these athletes that y'all are treating are getting older, you know, used to be when I started into practice, 65 was really, really old. Well, now 65 is nothing, you know? And so these patients are staying active for longer, and so that means that those injuries that they may have had when they were back in high school or back in college playing sports do certainly play somewhat into what they may be dealing with in their 60s and 70s. All right, so just to kind of put it in perspective, there's about 200,000 ACL injuries per year. Therefore, about 100,000 ACL reconstructions that happen per year. Every year, there's 50 million people diagnosed with arthritis, and there's about 600,000 total knee replacements performed every year. And so it's not to say what I'm doing or what I see a lot of is any more important than an ACL injury. It's merely to say, or just kind of put that in perspective, as we think, you know, there are those seasons where it seems like everybody tears their ACL. Well, there are those days, well, it feels like everybody has arthritis. Well, it's true, all right? So why does this matter to y'all, or should it matter to y'all? And the reality of it is treating young athletes, it probably shouldn't matter all that much. But part of the conversation that I have with patients many times, with patients that come in their 30s or 40s, they'll all talk about, gosh, you know, I shouldn't have played high school football. I shouldn't have played high school volleyball. You know, my knees are all shot because of that. The reality of it is that's not, in fact, true. You know, a lot of this is genetically based. Many times when I'm talking to patients about arthritis, I compare the cartilage in the knees to tread on a tire. If you take really good care of your tires, they're going to last. But if it's a 50,000 mile tire, you're only going to get 50,000 miles out of it. The problem is we don't get to pick our tires. Okay, so we're born with the tires, and so you can thank your parents or they can thank their parents about whatever tire they were born with. If you don't take really good care of your tires, well, then that 50,000 mile tire, instead of getting 50,000 miles out of it, you might get 40,000 miles. Those things kind of sound like maybe being a little overweight. Injuries in high school and college and things like that, they do play into it. Something that's important to remember is that, yes, we go in and reconstruct the ACL, and I think that's very, very important. And obviously, there have been changes to ways ACLs are done now compared to the way they were done 20 and 30 years ago. In fact, there's changes now compared to the way they were done 5 and 10 years ago. So the goals with this whole deal, with changing the way that ACLs are done, is trying to make the knee work more normally. A point I have to make regularly to patients, though, is that normal knees don't get operated on, okay? It doesn't mean that after an ACL reconstruction that patients can't return back. We know 87% of them go back to their pre-level function, okay? So there's a very, very good track record as far as ACL reconstruction is concerned. That being said, that knee is still not normal because normal knees haven't had an ACL tear. Normal knees haven't required surgery to fix that. And so that does play somewhat into their future. And it's not going to say that, hey, you know, because you've had an ACL reconstruction, you're for sure going to develop arthritis, but it is to say that certainly you have a slightly increased chance. Now, after we do the ACL reconstruction, there is a lower incidence of arthritis because the knee is working in a more normal way than it would be if there wasn't an ACL reconstruction. So again, I'm not trying to say that ACL reconstructions are futile, we shouldn't do them. I'm merely saying that we should do them. It is an improvement, and many patients go on and live a completely normal life. But once again, that's not a normal knee anymore. Obviously, meniscectomy, that's something that plays into this as well. It used to be, and many of the patients that I see, they come in with a telltale scar right over the medial part of their knee, and it's about 3 or 4 inches long. And basically what they were told when they were in college was, you know, meniscus, it ain't all that important. We're just going to take it out. All of it? Yeah, we're going to take all of it out. And so they used to do that. They used to cut the front part, the back part, and they just slipped that sucker out like a shrimp and put it on the back table, and they were done with it. And so we don't do that anymore, thankfully. In fact, you know, there's a lot of folks that when they're doing it, they've gotten more aggressive with repairing meniscus. And again, I'm sure there's been talks, or at least there will be talks about that sort of thing, because the success rate has gone up. So bottom line is that when a meniscectomy gets done, we want to do our best to take as little as we can, because guess what? The meniscus is important. Oh, excuse me. So just to kind of put this in perspective from a radiographic view, is that you can look at the knee on y'all's left and see that the joint spaces in between the femur and the tibia are very equal on the medial and lateral side. And so what will happen as we lose cartilage or lose tread, let me see if I can find the pointer, as we lose tread, we start to see this narrowing that happens over here, as well as the osteophyte or the bone spur that happens as a result of that. You can also see that in a weight-bearing view, the knee becomes a little more bow-legged, all right? And so when I'm at the movies with my wife and I'm walking behind an older couple and we're thinking, oh, they're so sweet, and I wonder how many years they've been married, or she's thinking that, I'm thinking, man, I could replace his knees. He's kind of walking like this, you know, and she hits me and I shut up. But bottom line is that yes, the most common deformity that will happen over time is called a varus deformity, and y'all are very, you know, familiar with that term, and it just means that they're becoming more bow-legged. So I say bow-legged in clinic because they understand it. But again, you'll start to see the narrowing of the joint space where that cartilage used to reside, and bone spurs. Bone spurs, I could go in and remove every bone spur in the knee, and I'm not going to do them any good. The bone spur is a reaction. The bone is merely just saying, you know, I have pressure on me that I'm not supposed to have on me, and so the bone spur is a reaction. Removing it's not going to do them any good, like I said. All right, so osteoarthritis, that's a wear and tear arthritis. Many times when I say you have arthritis, a lot of times, or talk to a patient about having arthritis, the especially if it's a female, she'll say, you're calling me old. I'm not calling you old, I'm just saying that your knee is worn out. Your knee is kind of old, you're just older. And so, when I say that, there's a little bit of confusion, right? Because most of the time when we say arthritis, what I'm talking about is osteoarthritis, a wear and tear arthritis that happens over time. Again, the tread wearing off of the tire, the cartilage wearing away in the joint. Don't get that confused with rheumatoid arthritis or psoriatic arthritis. Those are far less common. Yes, they are big problems, and we see that occasionally, but not near as commonly as what we see when we're talking about osteoarthritis. How's that going to manifest? They're going to be a little stiff. They've been sitting for a while in a car. When they get up to walk, their first couple of steps really, really hurt, and then they get warmed up and they start moving around a little better. And so that's a pretty common thing that I hear. I hear about that I can't sleep at night because my knee is throbbing so bad. Why does it hurt when I'm not doing anything? Well, you're paying for the sins of the day. And it's not that you were doing anything wrong necessarily. It's just that all you have to think about at night is sleep and your knee pain. And so night pain is a very, very common manifestation of arthritis. Soreness, many times it's more of a achy sort of pain as opposed to a very sharp pain. They will complain many times of popping that can have a sharp pain associated with it, but many times it's going to be more of that achy kind of toothache, dull, always there sort of pain that they're feeling. Swelling, of course, is a function of this as well. Anytime we say the word itis, right, inflammation, that deals with tendons, everything. We see that in all the various things, and of course, the joint can swell as well. Most of the time, patients will say, you know, they come in to see me, I've been dealing with this for about 5 years, and it's just gotten worse over time. Every once in a while, we will see somebody, my mom being a perfect example, who just saw me 2 weeks ago. I wouldn't operate on her, but just to say that she came to see me a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, up to 2 weeks ago, she was doing fine. So every once in a while, we see kind of an acute presentation of arthritis, and the way I tell patients about that is just to say, you've been walking on borrowed time. Your knee has been bad for some time, and fortunately, you've been kind of able to power through it, but the reality of it is that knee has been wearing for some time. It didn't just happen overnight. So those intermittent symptoms become more constant. I talked about difficulty sleeping, and then they'll also many times will come in and say, well, my leg's not straight anymore, you know? And every once in a while, about 8 to 10% of the time, they'll come in and they're more knock-kneed than what they can or what they're supposed to be. Totally different animal, but the same process going on. Instead of the medial compartment wearing out, the lateral compartment is wearing out. Vast majority of the time, it's going to be the medial compartment that wears out first, and that's why they'll be bow-legged the vast majority of the time. So what are our treatment options? Obviously, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, physical therapy, bracing, assistive devices, cane, walker, heel wedges, something, anything that we can do to offload that joint a little bit. Injections. Now, injections, that's something that you'll probably hear, have either heard about, will hear more about as you listen through the course of the next couple of days. But, you know, there's a bunch of injections that are out there. Everybody's heard of the steroid or the cortisone injection, of course. Just for whatever it's worth, I'm not a huge fan of a steroid injection in y'all's age patient, okay? I'm not to say that people that are doing it, it's wrong, but I am just to say that truly it's something that all it's going to do is going to kind of calm down the inflammation. And by calming down the inflammation, that's great, but really we'd kind of like to know, especially in a 17, 18, 20-year-old kid, what's causing it? Let's cure the problem. And so I'm not a huge fan of steroid injections. I'm 42. As I get older, of course, the age where I think it's acceptable gets older and older with me. And so I don't have any cutoff or anything like that, but I am a little hesitant. She was a basketball coach at Seven Lakes, or an assistant there at Seven Lakes. 32 years old, had one of the worst knees I've seen, and she had gone through, I think, played basketball at A&M, and she basically her knee looked like complete and total garbage. She had had multiple surgeries, but probably more important on top of that, she had had multiple steroid injections, because the treatment was, hey, let's get you back on the court, let's do everything we can, we'll give you a steroid injection, pat you on the rear, and say, have a good time. And so that can, over time, if administered inappropriately, it can have some deleterious effects on the joint. And so just keep that in mind. And again, I'm not saying change your referral patterns. If the physician that you talk to or refer to does steroid injections, I'm not bad-mouthing them. I'm just giving my opinion, which we've already determined really isn't worth much. All right? So viscous supplements, and so everybody's most likely heard about these. This is not PRP, this is not bone marrow aspirate, and we'll talk about those a little bit more. But viscous supplements, I always tell folks, it's kind of like an oil change in the knee. I go back to cars, right? The tread is worn out, but we talk about the oil change. Well, if your car has 50,000 miles on it, you take it in to get the oil changed, the parts still have 50,000 miles on them. The oil doesn't make the parts new again, okay? All it's doing is allowing those worn parts to function in a better environment. And so that's how I describe it to patients, just to let them know I'm trying to improve the environment in which your worn parts are working. But again, it's not going to regrow cartilage. You'll see all sorts of things on the internet. You'll see all sorts of things in the newspaper. You'll see all sorts of things on the news about regenerative medicine and all this stuff. And we'll get a little bit more into that. But unfortunately, that's not what's happening, okay? We're not regrowing cartilage. We are actually just lubricating the joint, hoping that it will work. The advantage to them is that 70% of patients get 70% pain relief for about 6 months. And so it's a longer period of time. Whereas the steroid injections, I tell folks, about 2 months. Now, obviously every rule is made to be broken. So that can be different from patient to patient. And I have that discussion with them as well. Typically, the viscosupplement injections, as well as the PRP and the BMA injections, those are reserved for my younger patients. And again, younger to y'all, not younger to y'all, younger to me. Anybody that's in their 40s, in their 50s, and even early 60s and really active with a mild to moderate degree of arthritis. If they have severe arthritis, viscosupplements probably aren't going to do them a whole lot of good. Although if they say they want to try it because they've had an uncle that had it and it worked wonders, well, heck, we'll pop it in there. It's no problem at all. But just so y'all understand some of the science behind it, again, it's not regrowing cartilage, not reversing that process of tread wear, because we can't rub anything on a tire and make the tread grow. We can't put special air in it. We can't put special gas in the vehicle. The bottom line, we can't drive backwards. None of that stuff. So we'll talk a little bit more about, and something that I think is important, a process that y'all start with most of your patients and most of your athletes. The two things that are important as far as what can patients do to prevent the progression of arthritis: stay active, maintain a healthy weight. It's very simple, right? Stay active, maintain a healthy weight. Activities that I typically recommend: swimming, biking, elliptical trainer, and walking. I left running off of that. That does not mean that I think running causes arthritis. If you have genetics that say you're going to get arthritis, yeah, it may accelerate things a little bit, but it's not to say running's bad. I run. I don't want a knee replacement if I don't have to. So bottom line is it's a good exercise. The second part of that, of course, is maintaining a healthy weight. Y'all know more and more as you look at your students that many of the folks that you're treating are becoming larger and larger. And in some cases, that's a really, really good thing, right? You know, I mean, we want them to be able to push the opposite team out of the way or whatever sport they're playing. It's not always a bad thing. But it is something when y'all are counseling patients about weight and things like that, it is an important thing to kind of keep in mind as far as their future is concerned. So I'll get back and talk about, we'll talk about PRP and BMA in just a second. So we have offloading braces. Essentially what that does is they say, okay, your knee's headed this way. We're going to try to push you this way. Looks kind of like an ACL brace, you know? So what we're trying to do is, again, offload that area by pushing their knee in a more normal alignment. I haven't found them to be really, really effective because everybody's body is not made the same way. Therefore, the braces don't always fit. And y'all have all had students that y'all have put in ACL braces following an ACL reconstruction. They say it slides down, it won't stay where it's supposed to, all that sort of stuff. And I agree, because everybody's leg is a little different, and so there's been some changes made to that. But most folks, as they get in their 50s and 60s, they're not really all that excited about putting a brace on every day over their pants and walking around in that. Again, it's not to say it's a bad idea. It's just something that, in application, I haven't seen that patients have been extremely over-impressed with that. All right, so platelet-rich plasma injections. Y'all are all, I'm sure, very familiar with this. I think this is a good thing that's out there. It's been shown to be equivalent to the viscosupplements or equivalent to the oil change, all right? And so it's something that we use in our clinic fairly regularly. Once again, it's usually patients that are in their 40s, 50s, maybe early 60s. And again, I don't treat birth certificates. I treat how they act, what their x-rays look like. And so I don't, again, put people in categories based on, hey, you're 65 years old, therefore you are not a candidate for, because, again, that's different from patient to patient. Essentially what's done, you draw some of their blood, you spin it down in a centrifuge, you grab the platelets off of it, you mix it with some magic crap, and you inject it back in their knee, all right? So, I mean, once again, it's not something that's going to regrow cartilage. There are a lot of people out there that are charging $1,200 for each injection. The FDA hasn't approved its use, and so they do have to pay out of pocket. There's a lot of people that are getting very wealthy off of these injections, telling patients that you're going to avoid a knee replacement if you have this injection. It might help, but they still might need a knee replacement, okay? And so again, I'm not saying it's a bad thing to do. I'm merely saying it shouldn't be sold as something, you know, that's going to reverse the arthritic change in their knee. The platelet-rich plasma, or the BMA. So bone marrow aspirate, this is the needle we use, and believe it or not, even though it's blown up on the screen, it's not a lot smaller than that. It's pretty large, and so what we're doing essentially is we're taking this big old hollow core needle and we're shoving it into their pelvis, or we're shoving it into their proximal tibia or their proximal humerus, just depends on what we're doing, and we're taking some of the bone marrow off of it, and again, preparing it, and then injecting it back into the knee, let's say, in this case. You'll hear about a lot of this getting done in ACL reconstructions and rotator cuff repairs and labral repairs and stuff like that. Again, trying to enhance the healing power that's in that joint. And so again, a very, very good thing to do there. What I don't want that to translate into, again, is that we can take some of your stuff out of you, inject it into your knee, and all of a sudden your knee will be new again. That's not going to happen. The process of arthritis is a very diffuse change, right? Instead of having one specific focal chondral defect, we have a lot of cartilage that's missing. And instead of that being a well-contained pothole, if you will, just the whole road sucks. And so because of that, we don't really have a way to deliver it into the knee that it's just going to stick to the bad areas. There are ways, if it's an isolated defect, and I think, again, in the sports world, that's a very, very important thing, and especially if we've got somebody that's in their, you know, teens or early 20s, we don't want to just be okay with the fact that they have a big defect in their cartilage. If it's a well-contained defect, using BMA in conjunction with some of the scaffolds that are out there can be extremely effective. And so, again, this does not, I don't want this to translate into what you hear or think or tell your athletes, all right? So usually after we stick this needle in them, they kind of look like that. Most of the time, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it asleep just because I don't like that face in my clinic if I don't have to see it. But I thought it was kind of funny. All right, so what's a total knee replacement? It's actually a knee resurfacing. Everybody thinks that what happens, many patients anyway, y'all probably don't, but many patients feel like what I go in and do is I cut the leg off here, I cut the leg off here, I chunk all that on the back table, and then I put this extremely large mechanical contraption in their knee in order to give them an entirely new knee. Well, the ACL and PCL are sacrificed. Both the medial and lateral meniscus are sacrificed. But most of everything else stays intact. So patellar and quadriceps tendons, all the tendons in the back, that medial collateral ligament, lateral collateral ligament, all stay the same. A knee replacement has always been this way, but it's called a knee replacement. And so patients understandably think it's the big thing that I'm talking about. And the reality of it is it's a knee resurfacing. So again, back to cars, it's kind of like retreading a tire. A lot of the tire stays theirs, all right? So we're removing the worn bone and cartilage from the end of the femur, the top of the tibia, and the back of the patella. That's replaced with metal and plastic, and it's held in place with cement. We don't use screws anymore if we can avoid it. That creates some issues that really y'all probably don't care about. But ultimately, I always tell my patients, it's really fancy metal, it's really fancy plastic, and it's really fancy cement, but it's still metal, plastic, and cement. That leads kind of into our therapy discussion afterwards. Bottom line is it's all hard objects that they can walk on, put weight on immediately, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. Obviously, part of the job is not just to give them new surfaces, but take their bow-legged knee and make it a little knock-kneed like it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be 3 to 5 degrees knock-kneed, and so that's part of the correction that happens. Can help the hip, can help the ankle. I don't sell it as that, nor am I trying to sell anything, I guess, but ultimately I tell them, if you have a hip problem, you're still going to have a hip problem. If you have an ankle problem, you're still going to have a hip problem. However, if the knee is appropriately aligned, that can be a good thing in the future. And so, again, that's why we continue to try to help not only with the surfaces themselves, but also the deformity. So this is, again, what I was talking about. I'm not going in and removing the bone here and here. I'm essentially just taking the surfaces off, and we do make it shape basically like that. Part of the reason I went into orthopedics is because drills and saws and hammers are kind of cool, and I get to use them in people. They're just really, really clean, and so I really, really enjoy that, of course. And then we put something that resembles this there, and there will be cement that's basically at that interface, cement at this interface. This is all modular, meaning that we have choices as to the sizes and things that we can use so that it fits the patient. We're not just kind of one size fits all kind of doing this. This is what it looks like postoperatively, of course, in the x-rays, they can't see the plastic. That always confuses them. Did you forget to put something in? No, I don't think I did. Anyway, and so this is, again, kind of comparing what does it look like before, what does it look like after, and you can see the drastic change in the deformity itself, and then also in the space between the two, once again, not being able to see that plastic. So when we talk about knee replacements, the advances, a lot of times folks think it's because the incision is smaller and the therapy, you know, all this sort of stuff. And the reality of it is that the implants themselves are fairly similar to what they've been for a long, long time. So there's not big, big changes that are made in the implants other than the plastic. The way the plastic is sterilized, the way the plastic is stored, the way the plastic is cross-linked, all of those things, that's what been the biggest change, because that bearing surface is what would degrade. When those particles would degrade, it would help to loosen the metal. And so the longevity of these implants has gone up, mainly because of changes in the bearing surface itself. 20-year survivorship, 80%. And so patients always ask me, well, how long is this thing going to last? Well, I see thousands of patients every year with knee arthritis, and the vast majority of them are not coming in saying, my knee's wore out. okay? And they may be 20 years out, and they'll come, and they might have some pain, but the reality of it is it's not because the knee is worn out for most of the modern era implants that are put in. It's a little different world because you think an ACL reconstruction, you know, recovery is a long, long time. We'll go ahead and put a knee in somebody and see them 20 years later. You know, it's a little different in that respect. So we don't have data that's, or we do have data, but short-term data and knee replacements really doesn't mean a whole lot to us. We expect them to be doing well at a year and 5 years and 10 years and 15 years. And so changes that are made do take a while to kind of cycle through so we can completely and totally understand if we actually made a difference with some of the changes that we made. The other thing that we're doing, and probably the biggest change, is multimodal pain protocol. And so what does that mean? We used to just give morphine. We used to give, codeine derivatives orally, and they would get constipated, they would get nauseated, they would vomit, they would hate us. I'd walk in the next morning after surgery, they'd want to hit me with a baseball bat, and I can't blame them really, because they not only were they constipated and throwing up, but they also weren't feeling all that great. It was hurting like crap. And so what we've gone in and done is really rethought the way that pain is treated. And the pain is treated with oral medicines prior to, not narcotics. Pain is treated with injections that we give during the surgery in the posterior capsule, the periosteum, the subcutaneous tissues. It's also treated with a different type of regional anesthetic that doesn't shut down their quads so they can get up and start moving right away. And then so we don't even use morphine anymore as a pain control agent because we don't need it anymore. Patients the next morning, you'd be surprised at how many patients after I've done what I've done to them, I walk in the next morning after surgery and literally they're complaining of a pain level of zero. I never would have believed that 10 years ago. I mean, it just doesn't seem like that's possible. But bottom line is that if you've had family members or family members that are considering this, the old way of managing pain is very, very different now. And so we are getting patients less pain quicker, which leads to a lot of other things in that we're early, mobilizing them early and getting them into outpatient therapy. A lot of times they'd stay in the hospital 3 or 4 days and then have to go to a skilled nursing facility or a rehab facility. A skilled nursing facility is what gets approved by insurance. That's like a glorified nursing home. I'm not doing this surgery on people who belong in nursing homes. I'm doing this on patients who don't want to be in a nursing home. They're walking like they belong in a nursing home. But after surgery, we don't want them feeling that way or looking that way. So I don't want them treated there. So what are some of the changes? Again, it used to be a 3 or 4 day stay in the hospital. Folks were on the CPM, the machine that moved them real slowly for about 6 hours a day. We've stopped using that because we've decided that 6 hours could be used in a much more productive way. SNF or rehab or skilled nursing facility versus rehab. Now they go home, and then we used to use staples. Now we use absorbable sutures. We use the Dermabond glue, and we use an occlusive dressing. And again, a lot of that probably y'all don't care too much about, but it's all to help fight infection. It's all to get them mobilized quicker. And strangely, you know, I think right now my length of stay in the hospital after total knee is 1.1 days. And so that's average all comers. And that's not just my 62-year-olds that get a knee replacement. That's all the way up to my old. This is actually 89. Don't think less of me because I said I did it. But bottom line is that 89-year-old is whipping most of my 59-year-old's butt. And so I threatened to bring him in regularly and say, hey, look, this guy's like 30 years older than you. You kind of suck. You should work harder, you know? So, you know, he'll tell you. Anyway, so again, I do realize that this isn't a horribly glamorous sports talk. It doesn't deal a whole lot. I wasn't lying. I do have NFL former NFL players that come and see me, and I do their knee replacements. Very rewarding because they still have that mentality about therapy and things like that. So it makes a huge, huge difference as far as recovery is concerned. And I just figured I'd put a couple things up that were kind of funny about old people. So there's that. No offense, Mike. And and this is just funny. And so anyway, if you have any questions, I'm here for however long you want me to be or until they kick me off the stage, but I'm happy to answer anything that I can answer.
Don't be shy. We're not going to charge.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, I have heard of prolotherapy, and the jury is still out. It's a good thing, and I'm all for that. I always tell folks, hey, if you wrap a chicken liver around your neck and it makes your knee feel better, wrap it up. You know, I mean, I'm totally fine with that. I mean, just because I don't completely and totally understand it, I don't have any problem with it. What I don't like is when people are selling things for unproven reasons for a lot of money. It just doesn't, that doesn't sit well with me. But do I think it's a wonderful adjunct in a way that can help them get better? Yes, ma'am. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. So typically, no. Yes, you can have hip arthritis and knee arthritis, but having knee arthritis doesn't necessarily increase significantly your risk of having hip arthritis. It's amazing how much more common knee arthritis is than hip arthritis. Knee arthritis, we see, you know, you'll see 50 or 60 of them, and then you'll see one or two hips. And so it's a just grossly weighted in the knee world. And if knee arthritis was causing hip arthritis, that ratio would be a lot closer to 1-to-1. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, and that's a great question. And so partial knee replacements are something that's out there, and it's a great operation. I love partial knee replacements. The problem is that partial knee replacements, if I have 100 patients that come into me for a knee replacement, okay, that they're candidates, they've tried all the non-operative stuff, 100 patients come into me for a knee replacement, only about 10 of them, maybe 15 of them are actually going to be candidates for a partial knee replacement. We have to know for a partial knee replacement on the medial compartment that they have an intact ACL. We need to know that those other ligaments are intact as well. We need to know it's a correctable deformity. And so there's a lot of criteria, and I'm a real stickler for criteria, and so when it comes to that, I don't push the indications at all. It is a wonderful operation. There actually is a knee replacement out there now that that preserves the ACL, the PCL, the MCL, and the LCL. Technically, it's a little more difficult, but difficult shouldn't stop us from doing anything. But the jury is definitely still out as if it makes any difference, because I've got patients that I'd be willing to put up against those, and I've done those types of ACL or ligament preserving knee replacements. And again, I think there's some value in exploring it. Once again, they came out, you know, within the last 5 years, and so we're waiting on 20 and 30 year data, and so unfortunately I guess I have to keep practicing to find out if it actually worked. Anything else? Yes, sir. I'm sorry? Yeah, so there's really no limit to the number of oil changes that you can have. However, every time you do it, you have a higher incidence of an aseptic reaction to that, meaning it's almost kind of like an allergic reaction. It seems kind of like an infection. I've only seen it about 3 times in my practice after just thousands and thousands of these injections, but it's always been in their second or third course. Vast majority of the time, if people have had 2 and 3 courses, it just doesn't seem to be as effective anymore. I always tell folks it's kind of like you're peeing on a forest fire at this point, or you brought a knife to a gunfight. You know, is that the monster that you're trying to kill is just bigger than what you're able to kill with that injection. So again, you can have it as many times as you want, and I don't mind doing that. As long as they're getting good relief and they're not having a reaction to it, I don't stop them from doing it. Most of them stop themselves. You know, they'll tell me, you know, the last one wasn't all that effective, and so I don't know that doing that again is going to be effective at all. Anybody else? Yes. PRP with that injection? No. And it's just because both of them are equally as effective. They have not been found at this time to be additive, if you will. And so do I mind doing it? Heck no, I don't mind doing it at all. We don't charge $1,200 for those, by the way, just for the record. We charge a little over what the kit costs us, so because patients need it and we're not trying to rape them. Yes. Say that one more time. You said infection and joint replacement. Yes. So better, and in fact, that's one of the big things that we've been working on out in our area, and actually system-wide through Memorial Hermann. It's a big deal, obviously, because you know a lot of folks think that if I get an infection on a cut in my skin, I can just wash it with soap and water, I take some antibiotics, and it's going to go away, right? Well, an infection after a joint replacement, I have to tell patients this, because now we're getting really dialed in on, is their BMI over 40? So are you classified as morbidly obese? Why do we care? Well, it makes the surgery a little harder, but once again, I don't shy away from hard, I'm shying away from infections, and so your infection rate is higher. Hemoglobin A1C, how's your diabetes controlled? If your diabetes isn't controlled effectively, well then you're obviously at risk, a higher risk for infection. So we're really, all of a sudden, the bone and joint guy, the stupid guy, has to start paying attention to labs and weight and all that other stuff. And so, yes, it's very, very important. The incidence is about 1%. We shoot for 0%, right? Is 0% reasonable? Probably not, but we're going to get there, okay? Or we're going to get as close as we can. We're making sure that people have stopped smoking. We're looking at their albumin and prealbumin levels, all these things that before, again, we just never even thought that were all that important or that were big factors. And so because infection is now publicly reported and it is such a devastating complication, real quickly, when they get a joint infection or a total joint infection, it's not unusual that you open the knee up, you take all those implants out, you leave them out for 3 to 6 months, they get 3 months or so of IV antibiotics, they walk around essentially without a knee for that entire period of time, and then they get to go through it again, and the risk of infection is still higher. So I have to tell patients that when I'm telling them, hey, you know what, your BMI is at 42. I really need you to lose weight. Well, I can't lose the weight. Well, I probably can't do your surgery. And why? Because I don't want you to get infected. So the rate is about 1%. We're shooting for zero, and we made big, big changes, or we're continuing to make changes literally every month to try and help fight that. Well, thank y'all. I do appreciate it.